Hello and welcome to Uncommon Law, my podcast about true stories from my life experience of over 50 years as a lawyer and trial judge. This is a look at the law from the inside out, stuff they don't teach in law school. This is Judge Rudy Greco, retired justice of the New York State Supreme Court. At the start of every boxing match, the last thing the referee says in his instructions to the contestants, both fighters, is, remember, protect yourself at all times. Well, this story shows how important that instruction can really be and how pertinent it really is. Wilfred Benitez became my client later on in his career. He was a professional boxer who had won already three professional titles. And when he was pursuing the fourth title, he became my client, which we'll connect up later on. It all started he was as a child prodigy. He was born in the South Bronx. He was the youngest of seven children. He had three brothers and three sisters, all of whom were older than he was. And he used to box for ice cream at the corner of 169th Street and Intervale Avenue in the South Bronx. His father had him box, and if he did good and sparred or he executed his lessons well and or anything else, his father would buy him an ice cream as a reward. And ice cream was hard to come by in the South Bronx, so Wilfred was highly motivated. When that was at 5 years old. At 6 years old, the family picked up and moved back to Puerto Rico, where the parents came from, to the town of Carolina, where Wilfred became active in youth boxing and became very, very prominent for the next 5 years or so, to the point where he even tried out in qualifications for the Puerto Rican Olympic team to represent his country at the Munich Olympics. And he lost at 112 pounds in the final qualification bout to a guy who was 5 or 6 years older than he was. And that guy turned out to be Wilfredo Gomez, who went on to become the 118-pound world champion, undisputed, who had a record of 21 straight title defenses won by knockout. He was a phenomenal fighter. So it was no shame for little Wilfred to lose to little Wilfredo. Right after the Olympics, the next big amateur boxing tournament was held in Central America. And it was just only about 2 months after the Olympics, or maybe 1 month after the Olympics. And Wilfred went and won the 112-pound title. And he won it by defeating a Cuban boxer who was 29 years old, one of these perennial amateurs, so-called amateurs, that was supported by Fidel Castro's Cuban government, a 29-year-old real de facto professional Cuban. And Wilfred beat him for the title. And when Wilfred won that title, he was 5 days past his 12th birthday, and he beat the 29-year-old Cuban. So you can see that he was indeed a child prodigy. Well, he went on. And his father was his manager. Gregorio Benitez was his manager. And Gregorio Benitez was a problem in any number of ways. First of all, it's never good for a father to manage his son. They can't be objective. And Goyo, they used to call him Goyo for short. Goyo was a real problem because he had a big, big ego, and he claimed he made Wilfred everything that he was. Meanwhile, he developed, he tried to develop his three other sons, and they all turned out to be mediocre boxers. They weren't anything special. Wilfred was special, but it wasn't because of his father. It was because he was dedicated and he had special gifts. Goyo lied about Wilfred's age, and he started his professional career at 15 years of age. They claimed he was 18. And they had phony papers. He boxed for a couple of years. And at the age of 17, Goyo had him quit high school in his senior year of high school to train for a championship challenge against a perennial world 140-pound champion from Colombia named Antonio Cervantes, who was a boxing legend in Latin America and a lot of other places as well. Cervantes is known as Kid Pambale, and he was a terrific fighter. 17-year-old Wilfred beat him for the 140-pound WBA, World Boxing Association-sanctioned championship belt. And his father, being a boaster and a loudmouth and an egomaniac, and by the way, he was also a degenerate horse player, a gambler, and a heavy drinker. He goes on and immediately puts his foot in his mouth as a manager by saying at the press conference right after Wilfred won the WBA belt, "My son is bigger than any rating organization, WBA, WBC, WBO, or WB anything." And it's a stupid thing to say. He doesn't need any of these rating organizations. Well, he did, because they sanctioned the belts, whether you like it or not, and they're recognized, like it or not. And Wilfred's belt was taken away within 1 year because his father, disregarding the importance of the rankings in the rating organization, had Wilfred failed to make a mandatory title defense against the number one contender within 6 months. So they gave him extra time, and 1 year he didn't make any title defense, and it was mandatory to do so. They took the belt away, and he lost the franchise because having a boxing championship belt is like in business is like having a franchise to make money. That belt is a franchise. So Goyo took Wilfred to New York. Everybody knew him by now. He won the 140-pound world champion. He wasn't an unknown. And he came to New York to start his career here in New York before the New York audience, which is always the best money in boxing at that time. And he fought at Madison Square Garden, which is where I first saw him fight. He fought Bruce Curry, and it was a notable fight. I've never seen anything before or since, because Bruce Curry was a terrific fighter. He was a top welterweight, 147-pound contender, and Wilfred was growing now. He was no longer a 140-pound fighter. And in fighting Curry, Wilfred was a little cold, apparently, at the first round. He hadn't really properly warmed up, probably. And he got tagged, which was uncharacteristic because he was a phenomenal defensive fighter, very hard to hit. Curry tagged him with a devastating right hand, and it was such a terrific punch that Wilfred Benitez fell forward flat on his face. He didn't even have to, he was out cold standing up when he got hit, because his hands didn't even come out to break his fall. I never saw anybody land in a boxing match face forward like that. And what's even more remarkable, it was the first round of the fight, and Wilfred was in good shape. He got up, and he took an 8 count. I think hitting the canvas woke him up. He got up, took an 8 count, and went on to win the fight. All right, it was disputed. It was a very close fight. It could be a decision one way or the other. But the fact that he just survived and went on to make a competitive fight, win or lose, was just remarkable in itself. I never seen that before, and I never did since. That was fantastic. Well, Wilfred went on, and his father was looking to sell his contract because he couldn't manage him anymore under the circumstances. He was advised, you know, you're ruining your son with all these rating organizations. You're not going to get anywhere. They're not going to help you out. And he decided he could sell the managerial rights to Wilfred's contract. And Teddy Brenner was the matchmaker at Madison Square Garden, who was helping Goyo get Wilfred fights. And Teddy Brenner was an astute, one of the most astute judges of boxing talent in the world, because he was making matches all the time at Madison Square Garden, which is at that time the mecca of boxing, as they say. Teddy proclaimed, for anybody who would hear it, and it was in the papers, quoted as saying, "Wilfred Benitez is the most gifted fighter I've seen since Sugar Ray Robinson." Now, Sugar Ray Robinson, that's a big comment, because Sugar Ray Robinson was, by popular acclaim in the modern era, pound for pound, the best boxer fighter that anybody saw in the professional ring. So putting Wilfred Benitez in Ray Robinson's class was quite a compliment. Well, Teddy Brenner got a management deal for the sale of Wilfred's management rights with Jim Jacobs and Bill Caton. Jim Jacobs and Bill Caton were partners, were businessmen. They were very, very fine gentlemen, good people, and they were in big business and men of integrity. You could do business with these guys on a handshake, and a lot of people did, and they were wonderful people. Their business was the Big Fights, Inc., where they went around to the whole world and accumulated, bought, acquired all the archival boxing film in the world. They had 95% of it in their possession. and he used to license it to television networks around the world. Anybody who wanted to show any kind of old boxing film for anybody, they had to go to the Big Fight Sink. So these guys were astute guys and very good, and they knew Wilfred's talent, and they were very, very good guys, very smart and decent people. They bought the contract from Goyo and took over Wilfred's management. But it wasn't without problems, because Goyo, being the type of individual that he was, gave them a hard time and second-guessed them in everything they did. And all they ever did as managers, they were superb managers. They always put Wilfred in the best light in all the fights that he had, and always negotiated the best possible deal they could. They were, as I said, they were astute businessmen, very, very smart. And it was always against the tide, because Goyo was always criticizing them, telling them, don't listen to those guys in the suits there in New York. You know, I'm your father. You listen to me. Well, he was jealous of those people, in spite of the fact that they were making Wilfred a lot of money. They set Wilfred up for numerous interviews with the international companies for endorsement purposes. Wilfred was very attractive, and Goyo interfered and wouldn't let Wilfred go to any of the interviews, thereby blowing the opportunity for additional hundreds of thousands of dollars at the time in endorsements. But that was Goyo. He was all about himself and not about his son. And they made matches. Caton and Jacobs made matches for Wilfred, always putting him in the best light, as I said. And that meant Wilfred, as a counterpuncher, you always had to match him with people who were aggressive and came forward, because if you matched him with another counterpuncher, each of them would be waiting for the other one to throw a first punch, and that would be like watching paint dry. And boxing is show business, and you want to have an attractive fight. And so they were always very careful to match Wilfred with somebody in a complimentary style that was designed to make his style look especially good and showcase his talents, which were profuse. They qualified and they got Wilfred up to the point where he was the mandatory challenger for the 147-pound world championship, the welterweight championship. And the current champion was Carlos Palomino, who was a delightful young guy. He was a Chicano, a Mexican-American from East Los Angeles, who was college-educated. He's a good guy. He became a television commentator. He was a very nice personality. And Carlos was the champion, and Wilfred was the mandatory challenger. And they negotiated with Carlos Palomino and his people to have the championship fight take place in Puerto Rico, which was at first out of the question to Carlos. He owed his allegiance to his promoters in Los Angeles, who nurtured his career from nothing. And he always said all his title defenses were going to be in Los Angeles. But Jimmy Jacobs and Bill Caton said, Carlos, if we can fill the stadium in San Juan, Puerto Rico, to watch Wilfred. He's a phenomenon in the country, and if you fight him over there, the fight will be worth a lot more money. The purse will grow a lot more. Carlos said, that's nice, but I don't care about that. He said, I want to fight in Los Angeles. They said, well, we'll give you a piece of Wilfred's purse. It's going to be X amount of dollars more than you thought, but we'll give you more than some of Wilfred's purse. Carlos said, no thanks. They said, well, we'll give you a little bit more than that. Actually, a lot more than that. And Carlos said, no thanks again. And finally, they made a third and final offer, and it was a large chunk of Wilfred's purse. And Carlos succumbed to the idea of making that much more money for his fight, and it would be in a bigger venue in Puerto Rico. They could raise and charge a lot more money. And the title fight took place in Puerto Rico at the Hiram Bithorn Stadium, the baseball stadium of the San Juan professional baseball team. It was packed with about 30,000 people, standing room only. Wilfred won a split decision that night, and he won the title, which is a rare thing in boxing, to win a title by a split decision from a champion, because the unwritten rule in boxing is if you're going to take the title, you have to win decisively to take the title. As a challenger, if it's even close, the benefit of the doubt goes to the champion. If you're going to win, you have to win by a decisive margin. Well, the fight was close. But here's the thing. Everything Wilfred had done in the fight was greeted by thunderous applause of 30,000 people. Everything Carlos Palomino done when it was positive was greeted by his three Chicano cornermen, and that was it. There were 30,000 people cheering for Wilfred and three people cheering for Carlos Palomino. And that swayed the judges. There's no doubt about it. It was a close fight, but that swayed the judges' judgment. gave Wilfred high marks for everything that he did, and maybe too high, and Carlos got lesser marks, maybe too low under the circumstances. In fact, the next day, two sports writers, Dick Young from the Daily News and Michael Katz from the New York Times, called Jimmy Jacobs up to congratulate him. And being writers, they don't really know what goes on in the business of boxing. It's a business. And they told Jimmy essentially the same thing. Congratulations, boy, were you lucky the fight was in Puerto Rico. And Jimmy, characteristically being a very tight-lipped guy and keeping his business to himself, close to the vest, said, you're right, we were lucky. He never divulged the fact that he had paid Palomino a premium to have that fight in Puerto Rico. But now, that was good management because the franchise of that 147-pound belt was belonging to Wilfred Benitez and his managers. Next fight coming along at 147 pounds, the next contender was none other than Sugar Ray Leonard, who had just come from the Olympics and built a professional career. He was being very well managed and handled, and he was very talented and had a huge following because of his Olympic fame. And he had a very good-looking young man and a terrific personality, and he knew how to do his own PR. He was very, very good, and he was very well-guided. And he was a mandatory challenger. Well, Jimmy Jacobs and Bill Caton negotiated with Ray Leonard's business advisor, who was an attorney, Mike Trainer. And they are very proud. They were very proud of the fact that Wilfred Benitez is the only guy who fought Sugar Ray Leonard who got the biggest share of the purse, other than Ray Leonard, because he was such a big draw. He always got the biggest share of the purse. And Wilfred fought Ray Leonard. It was a very, very close fight up until the very last round, when uncharacteristically in the last round, the referee stopped the fight and declared it a TKO against Wilfred Benitez because, I say uncharacteristically, because first of all, it was the last round. Second of all, he stopped it on a cut. But the cut, it was a serious cut, and it was bad looking, but it wasn't that harmful because it was on the hairline of Wilfred's forehead, which was high to begin with. It wasn't something that was really blocking his vision or anything else right near his eye or anything else. But he was bleeding profusely, and the referee made a judgment call and stopped the fight, and it was controversial. Some people thought Benitez was very close or even ahead. Other people argued the other way around for Ray Leonard, but it doesn't matter. He lost the fight. But Jacobs and Caton had been very astute in making the contract with Sugar Ray Leonard. At that time in boxing, you couldn't have a contract that said with the other fighter, the loser will get the next fight, the return match, a return match clause, an immediate return match clause. That was forbidden because people would just keep tying it up and then each guaranteeing the other one a return match, a return match, a return match, and then the whole thing would be stagnant and nobody else would get into a championship fight for a long time. So that was outlawed, but Jacobs and Caton had negotiated with Mike Trainer. They said, we can't have the next fight rematch, but we want to rematch the fight after your next fight. And they got it in the contract because they had the championship, and they forced Leonard to accede to that condition. Well, Leonard's next fight, when he won the title from Wilfred, was with Roberto Duran. And it was a big, big, big multi-million dollar fight. A lot of publicity. It was a clash of two of the outstanding boxers in the world. And Duran beat Ray Leonard that night. But it was close and it was controversial, but he beat him solidly. And everybody wanted to see a rematch because Ray Leonard, even though he lost, he fought a good fight. He fought a valiant fight. And it was a great fight. And people were very excited, and his supporters thought that he could beat Duran if they had a rematch. Well, they got waivers from the various boxing organizations, the world organizations that accredit these things. They were up for sale anyway. They bought their way into waivers. And they said, in this case, there could be, because there's popular demand, there could be an instant rematch. And Duran should give Ray Leonard, can give, will allow him to give Ray Leonard an immediate rematch. Except, even though he had the waivers from the boxing organizations, the rating organizations, he had a contractual obligation to Wilfred to fight Wilfred next. And when the negotiations were over, the problem is always solved in boxing, as always, by money. Wilfred was paid by Ray Leonard's people $250,000 to waive his next fight with Sugar Ray Leonard. So he did. And that was a wild situation because Ray Leonard, in the next fight in Montreal, he fought Duran. He beat him. He frustrated him by changing his tactics and boxing him and staying away. And he got Duran so disgusted that Duran quit in frustration. No mas, no mas was the famous quotation, no more, no more. And that was the end of that fight. And when Duran went home to Puerto Rico, his house was stoned by his countrymen in Panama. I mean, he went home to, excuse me, Panama, and his house was stoned by his countrymen who couldn't believe that he, you know, in a macho country, Latin country, that this guy gave up and cost them. They had all bet the ranch on their national hero, and rightly so. And he gave up, and he was now disgraced. And they asked Mrs. Duran what happened. And you have to understand that Wilfred Benitez and Roberto Duran were both rivals for the uncrowned title of best Latin boxer. They were both jealous of each other's career. So Mrs. Duran, when they asked her, what happened to your son? How did he quit like that? It's disgraceful. What happened? They stoned your house. She says, oh, Doña Clara Benitez, Wilfred's mother, they're very jealous of my son Roberto, and they put a spell on my Roberto. That's why he lost the fight to Ray Leonard. That's why he quit. He was under their spell. And Sports Illustrated went right to Puerto Rico and interviewed Doña Clara Benitez. They said, Mrs. Duran said, you put a spell on her son Roberto. That's why he lost. What happened? What have you got to say? She says, oh, no, I'll tell you what happened. She said, Senora Duran put a spell on my son, Wilfred, because they were jealous of Wilfred's success. And she didn't do it right, so it backfired on her son, and that's why he lost to Ray Leonard. So welcome to boxing. It's a crazy world, and it always was. In fact, later on in Wilfred's career, when I took over, I looked over his checkbook, which his sister Miriam used to keep as his bookkeeper, and they had written a check for $25,000 she had written for miscellaneo. And I asked her, I questioned the check. I said, Miriam, this is miscellaneo. What's miscellaneo? What's it for? Oh, she says, my mother told me to go to Haiti to get voodoo so that they cast a spell on Wilfred so that he doesn't get married to Elizabeth. Elizabeth was his fiancée and his childhood sweetheart. And she was convent-educated, and they felt that if he married her, they would lose control of Wilfred and access to all his money, which was very important because he made $9 million. But all he ever took after any fight, and regardless of the purse, was a couple of $1,000s, and he'd go party in a disco for a week or so and then go back in the gym. And his parents and his brothers and sisters, but mostly his father, took all the money, and they left him with the tax implications. They never paid taxes on any of his fight, and he was in a 50% tax bracket. For every nickel he owed, he earned, he owed another nickel in taxes. And in 1 year, he made $2.5 million, and H&R Block did his taxes, and he owed terrific amounts of money to the government. But the family never. Let that stop them from helping themselves to all the money that he earned. Well, Wilfred grew again. He was still growing. He was a young man, and he won under the aegis of Bill Caton and Jimmy Jacobs, the 154-pound world championship from Maurice Hope, and he was growing still, and he wanted a campaign as a middleweight, 160 pounds. And that's when I became involved. He, at that point in time, retained me as his lawyer because he was just now married and he wanted to take over his own affairs. He didn't want his mother and father to dictate to him what he had to do and how he had to do it. He wanted to take over his own affairs, and he asked me to represent him, and I said I would, and no problem. He says, I always want to take care of my parents. I love them. But I do want to, you know, I want to be able to make my own decisions independent of what they say. So that's fine. And Wilfred was going to embark on the Jacobs and Caton on a career, on a campaign to become the 160-pound world champion, middleweight world champion. And that title was held by Marvin Hagler, who was a formidable fighter. But Marvin Hagler was very aggressive and a terrific fighter, and his style would have been very complementary to Wilfred's style. So Wilfred had a very good chance of beating Marvin Hagler because styles make fights in boxing, and at least his style was complementary to Wilfred. Wilfred was supposed to sign a three-fight contract with Don King, a promotional contract for his campaign as a middleweight. And the first fight was supposed to be a guy named Johnny Cerda to get at 160 pounds, and that's to take place at the Dunes Hotel. And Wilfred was going to fight Johnny Cerda, who was a journeyman, a good one, but a journeyman, and to get acclimated to the weight. And if he won that fight, he was to fight the number one contender, who at that time was a Syrian immigrant named Mustafa Hamshaw, who was a brute of a fighter. He was a mauler, which was also suitable to Wilfred. Wilfred can handle those guys and box and keep away from them. He was a plotter, Hamshaw, tough guy, nice guy, tough guy, but he didn't have any speed in him at all. He was a mauler, and that was good. And if Wilfred won that fight, the winner of the Hamshaw Benitez fight would fight Marvin Hagler for the title. And if Wilfred would go for the an unprecedented fourth title, nobody had ever done that in modern times. That fight, Wilfred against Marvin Hagler, would be worth an easy $5 million for each of the fighters. So it was a very lucrative proposition. So Wilfred's training in Gleason's gym, and he calls my office one day, and he said, "You have to meet me at Don King's office right away. Go right away to meet me at Don King." I said, "What's going on?" He says, "My mother and father just flew from Puerto Rico, and they are in a car. Don King sent a limousine. And they're coming to pick me up. They told me to finish the workout and get cleaned up because we're going to Don King to sign contracts for my middleweight fights. And I want you to be there, okay?" I said, "Sure, I'll be there." I said I would, and I would. So I immediately hustled over to East 67th Street to Don King's brownstone and his big offices. And turns out I was the last one there by a couple of minutes. And I walked upstairs to I was shown up to a big conference room with a large mahogany conference table, you know, a very impressive sort of thing. And there's Don King with his hair standing up on the one end. And Jim Jacobs got up, shook my hand, and introduced me around. And he introduced me to Wilfred's parents, Doña Clara, and his father, Goyo, who both of whom glared at me because they didn't want anybody interfering with their influence over their son. And then Don King. And I sat down, and I no sooner sat down, and King jumped out of his chair, comes over to me, towering over me, and starts in a blustery, loud, bombastic voice, "You trying to drive a wedge between this boy and his parents, blah, 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 blah," really loud and bombastic and you know, overbearing. He's trying to bully me. And I just looked up at him. I sat in my chair. I just looked up at him. I said, "I think you come from Cleveland, if I'm not wrong, right? And maybe in Cleveland, that act works and intimidates people. But where I come from Brooklyn. That doesn't work in Brooklyn. So we're here to do business. And if you want to do business, you'll go back and take your seat. And next time you speak, we'll speak about business, and you'll speak in a civil tone of voice and about business matters. And everything else doesn't count. And if you don't want to do that, well, Wilfred and I will get up. And we'll walk out of here, and maybe or maybe not, we'll be back to do business at some better time when you feel better. Maybe. That's if we don't do business somewhere else. So it's up to you." King looked at me, turned around, went back to his seat, sat down, and started talking about the fights. "Oh, Wilfred, I love you." And Wilfred, character, he's getting coverage from what I just did with Don King. And he says, "Yeah, well, if you love me, how come you're trying to steal my money?" "Oh, Wilfred, how could you say that? I love you, man." I said, "Well, this is not Valentine's Day anyway. Let's talk about the business at hand," which was the three-fight contract, which was all preordained. Jimmy Jacobs did the best he could. But there was a catch. With Don King, there's always a catch. The mother and father were there because Don King was now handing us an IOU for $50,000 in advance that he was giving to Goyo Benitez to go to the racetrack or wherever he or you know, buy liquor or whatever he was going to do with the $50,000. And he wanted Wilfred to sign to pay the $50,000 out of the purse from his first fight as a middleweight. And I said, "Excuse me, but let me understand. You're giving $50,000 to Goyo Benitez and you want Wilfred Benitez to pay." He said, "Yeah, that's right." And that's what Don King used to do. He'd always exploit any fighter's weakness, whatever it was. And in Wilfred's case, the weakness was his father. He would give his father advances and have Wilfred sign for somewhat less money than he was really worth because he had them compromised, you know, and obligated to him by virtue of the father's need for money, constant need for money. And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, we're not going to sign this. Wolf is not going to sign it. If you're going to lend the money to Gregorio Benitez, then you have Gregorio Benitez sign it. Now, you want to cross out Wilfred's name and do that, or you want to send upstairs to your lawyers and have them draw up a new IOU, or you want me to do one right now, I can do one on the back of an envelope and in a legally binding way, and you have Goyo sign it. We're not going to do it. All right, forget about it. Don King put that down, and we signed the promotional contracts. Walked out, and on the way out, Jimmy Jacobs out on the sidewalk on 67th Street said, can I see you a minute, Rudy? I said, yeah. He took me out of earshot, and he put his hand out. He said, I want to shake your hand. I said, what's that all about? He says, I never saw anybody put Don King down the way you did, and you did it without raising your voice or using foul language or getting angry or anything else. He said, I never saw anybody overcome Don King with that act. That he pulls. He said, and you did it. And he says, I'm going to tell you something else. When you walked out, Wilfred stood up and he was so proud of himself and you for standing up to his mother and father. And he said, and I want you to know, and this is another reason why I'm shaking your hand, he said, because today Wilfred faced and overcame the three most dangerous adversaries of his life, which was Don King, his mother, Doña Clara, and his father, Goyo Benitez. He said, and you did it. And my hat's off to you. I said, well, that was a big compliment from Jimmy, who was probably one of the most astute businessmen I had ever come across in my life. He was very, very sharp. So I took that as a real compliment. And Wilfred went on. He fought Johnny Cerda at 160 pounds in Vegas. I worked his corner. It was nationally televised bout at the Dunes Hotel. And he then went on to fight Mustafa Hamsho in the title elimination bout and uncharacteristically lost. He was out of shape. I've never seen him out of shape, but he was out of shape for that fight. And he stood in the corner and he let Hamsho maul him for 12 rounds. He just stood in the corner immobile and protected himself and let Hamsho pile on points, mostly with punches that didn't even land cleanly, but he did nothing to help himself, and he lost that fight. Never fought Marvin Hagler, lost that big payday. His contract with Jacobs and Caton ran out, and he tried to resuscitate. He was never the same after that. He tried to resuscitate his career. Somebody picked up his management, and they had him in Argentina boxing a couple of fights, but it never happened. And Wilfred ended up, to my knowledge, very, very sadly in Puerto Rico, where he still lives with one of his sisters, and I heard, I'm pretty sure this is true, that he was in a wheelchair and he was wearing a diaper because he's incontinent, and he had a bib because he's drooling on himself, and he gets a small pension from the city of Carolina, a small pension from the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and he's on Social Security disability as a U.S. Citizen. And he was a fabulous defensive fighter, but he took a lot of punishment cumulatively over the years since he was fighting since he was 5 years old. And it brings to mind, again, what the referees tell fighters at the beginning of every fight, and that's to protect yourself at all times. And Wilfred, in this case, didn't protect himself from his own family and his own career, kept fighting and didn't protect himself and overdid it and paid a terrible and tragic price. Thanks for listening. Come back next week for another episode of Uncommon Law, Lessons They Don't Teach in Law School. I'm Judge Rudy Greco. Court is adjourned.